Hello, friends. Kyle Tierman here, and I hope you're all having a wonderful day from wherever you are listening to my voice. Book recommendation time. I love reading. I love recommending books at the beginning of this podcast, so if you're just tuning in for the first time, expect more of this. The book that I'm going to recommend today is called A Carnival of Snackery by David Sedaris, and it is a collection of journal entries from one of the funniest writers in the world over decades. So they're very short chapters, and they're just observations from his day. And I know what you're thinking, that sounds lame, but I promise you it's not. These are just quick little 300 to 500 word chapters. You can read them over a cup of coffee, and they'll just brighten your day. I've heard that David Sedaris will journal about his day prior. That's his writing exercise. So whatever he did the day before, the next day, he will write about it in detail. And it's remarkable how much material he's able to accumulate from that simple practice. I had the pleasure of going and seeing David Sedaris in person at a theater in Los Angeles a few weeks ago, and it was huge. It was at the Ace Theater in LA, and sold out, packed show. Just remarkable the kind of draw that guy has, and how popular his work is, and how really it's just his whole career has been essentially a collection of memoirs, little snapshots from his life, family, self, travel, and somehow it never feels too self-indulgent or annoying, because he just has a very keen observational eye for the world. So that's the book recommendation, A Carnival of Snackery by David Sedaris. Super fun one. Also, want to recommend going over to my Substack page, where I release a newsletter every Friday. It's also where you can engage with this podcast. If you have comments, recommendations for new guests, you can go to tierman.substack.com or just click the link below. This podcast is with Anupa Asokan. And this episode was largely centered around the MPA issue, the Marine Protected Area issue along California coast, and the broader issue of 30 by 30, which is a hot-button issue, a contentious issue, and something that I'm honestly just learning about now. So I would not consider myself a subject matter expert by any means yet, and it was me asking a lot of stupid questions to someone who knows quite a bit more about this. I think that if you are an ocean lover and you want to get involved in a really important issue right now, this would be a good one. So I'm hoping that it can help bring more of you up to speed, as it certainly brought me up to speed. Anupa, as a bit of a background, is a water woman and ocean advocate dedicated to protecting our marine environment. Previously, she worked for the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, the World Surf League, and led the Ocean Initiative and Government Affairs at XPRIZE Foundation. Currently, she works at the National Resource Defense Council, advocating for meaningful ocean protection and equitable coastal access through 30 by 30 initiative. Anupa also serves on the National Board of Directors for Surfrider Foundation, is a graduate of UCLA, and holds dual master degrees from the University of Rhode Island Graduate School of Oceanography and College of Business. Beyond her advocacy work, Anupa spends her free time surfing, fishing, diving, and stand-up paddleboarding along Southern California's coast, and we talked quite a bit about that as well in this episode. Please welcome to the show, Anupa Asokan.
Kyle Cameron here. I'm in Cape Town.
I was the only journalist in northern Nigeria.
Not an adventure until you get lost in Tijuana.
You get caught inside by a giant wave, you feel really alone.
I love the adventure of waking up and not knowing what will happen and that being my job.
I'm standing at a desert oasis right now.
A lot of tourists don't see this part of Bali.
Smiles and thumbs up.
Okay. All right. Anupa, thank you so much for coming over here.
Thank you for having me.
All right. You just casually mentioned your paddle across the bay, and I wanted to ask you a little bit more about that. So you said your goal was to see basking sharks
yes.
on the paddle, but that did not happen, but you did see some whales.
I did see some whales. So I joined the Surfrider National Board of Directors. And then 2020 happened, and, you know, we weren't going anywhere.
What happened then?
You know, just, you know, couldn't really go anywhere. Spent a lot of time on our own.
For a couple years.
Yeah. But part of that is, you know, helping fundraise for the organization. And I was just getting out on my paddleboard a lot. And so I decided to turn that into something positive for Surfrider. So I decided to paddle from Point Doom to Palos Verdes, which is essentially the Los Angeles coastline across the Santa Monica Bay, and, you know, use that as an opportunity to highlight some of the biodiversity that we have around Southern California and also raise some money for a good cause.
That's super cool. Paddleboarding is like, I have a lot of friends that are into paddleboarding, and I've never really gotten into it, but they kind of claim this excitement that I'm only starting to glean, like, for me, because I'm like, why would I want to paddle more? Like, as a surfer, that's you're trying to reduce the paddling and increase the wave catching. But what they're talking about, they're like, no, on a downwinder, which is what you did,
mm-hmm.
going from north to south, you can actually catch little waves as they're breaking on, or not even breaking, but like the swells on a windy day. And it gives you the feeling of riding a wave down the coast.
Yeah. So I actually do stand-up paddling.
Oh, you do?
Not
okay.
prone. And I love it because I like the vantage point. I like to nerd about all the critters that you see in the ocean. And so it's a really good perspective if you have some nice polarized sunglasses.
Right.
You know, you never know what you're going to see.
Totally. It is funny how when you're prone surfing or paddle boarding, you can't really see under the water.
Right.
But the second you stand up, just having that, you know, 4 feet of like being able to look down, all of a sudden, if it's a clear day, you're looking down into that aquarium right there.
Yeah, absolutely.
I did a really fun trip like down the Big Sur coast mm-hmm. a while ago, and I hadn't really done any like stand-up paddleboarding, but those things are shaped totally different than a stand-up paddleboard that you might surf on, right?
Yeah, so I was using has like a displacement hull that you would use for racing, essentially. So once you start going, you know, you're really gliding and kind of cutting through the water versus a planing board, which is more like what you would surf on,
right?
Is it displacement? There's chop.
Is it displacement hole just like it's cut more sharply around the nose?
Yeah, think more like a kayak or a canoe, right? Like you sort of have a bit of a keel, not completely, but at least it cuts through the water
right.
at the front,
okay.
sort of pointed at the front.
What kind do you use?
I did that paddle on a 12-foot bark board.
Yep.
By Surf Tech. I'm thinking of doing another paddle this year. I might do a Catalina crossing.
Sweet.
And I was thinking about going from marine protected area to marine protected area, from Catalina to, like, you know, San Pedro area or Palos Verdes area.
Wait, say that again. From
So Long Point is a marine protected area
okay.
on Catalina Island.
Got it.
I actually used to live and work at the camp right there at Long
really?
Point. So it's a little bit like going home and then coming to maybe Point Vicente. Haven't quite figured out the details yet,
right.
but that would take me from marine protected area, which is like an ocean park, to another ocean park.
Right. Okay. So to give people a little bit of geography who aren't familiar with Southern California,
Your paddle was from, you said, from Point Doom to Palos Verdes. Mm-hmm. So Point Doom is the northern edge of Los Angeles, close to the county line.
Yeah.
And it's a marine protected area.
Yes.
So it's like, really, it's one of the best places that you can go diving to see wildlife.
Absolutely,
along,
yeah,
like the California coast, just mm-hmm. because there's so much of it, because they don't have hunting pressure around the Point Doom area. And then you went, and then Palos Verdes is, I guess, close to the, is that close to the southern county line of Los Angeles?
Yeah, I guess technically San Pedro and Long Beach are still LA County, which are a little bit further south, but
right.
pretty close.
Right. And Palos Verdes has certain parts of it that are protected.
Correct.
From fishing and spearfishing and that kind of thing, but then there are areas where you can still go out recreationally and fish.
Yeah, that's okay. Correct. So there's a lighthouse out on Palos Verdes. That's a good sort of landmark to tell you where the protected area is, Point Vicente.
How far was the paddle?
It was 27 miles.
Cool. How long did it take?
It took me over 8 hours. So I had a nice downwind swell and swell pushing me for the first, I don't know, 2 hours. And then I would say the last 9 miles, the wind was at my side. So it got a little brutal. But
pushing you in?
So like pushing
more,
me in.
More
and so
west wind?
Yeah, a lot of my energy was going just into staying balanced
right.
on the board.
Cool. And what kind of, are you just bringing water bottles and electrolytes and some?
Yeah, I wore a Camelback.
Cool.
And I had a, thankfully I had a chase boat, because there was one point where I was completely fogged in and couldn't see. And I kind of knew the direction of the swell and I stuck with that, but I had to ask the boat to lead the way and I just followed the sound of the engine.
Right, right. Yeah, west wind will just push the fog in.
Yeah.
Right. That's so scary. I interviewed these guys called the, you might have heard them, the Hickenbotham twins. They did a prone paddle from, it took them like 6 months, and they went from the border of northern Alaska to Mexico. Oof. And it was, did you hear? They're such badasses. And they did it like, there no real media around it for like a year or two afterwards. They were just like these, you know, I think they're like 24-year-old kids, and they're just like little super athletes who are like, we're just going to do this. But they said that there was a point in Alaska where the tide started sucking out really strong, because they have such big tide swings up there. And they got fogged in, and all of a sudden they were getting pushed out to sea, couldn't see the shore, and ran into a fishing boat and were like, we need to, like, where is shore? We need to get to shore. But, like, one crazy story after the next, getting fogged in these remote areas.
Yeah, I mean, I was paddling and training along the LA coastline,
right.
So not necessarily remote. But, yeah, the weather can kind of turn on a dime. Wind shifts, and, you know, as much as you check the forecast sometimes.
Totally.
Yeah.
It's cool, I would imagine, you know, just seeing different perspectives of a coastline from out there. I think that that's one thing that a lot of people, that's like a real aha moment for people when they first go out into a boat along a coastline that they've maybe lived at for their whole lives. All of a sudden they're like, wow, I'm seeing this town from a totally new perspective. Like, rather than looking out at this ocean, you're in the ocean, you're looking back at land. And that's really one of my favorite things about, whether it's just being on a boat or like getting a little further out offshore, is that perspective shift.
Yeah, and I just like exploring, right? Sometimes I'll just go straight out if it's a nice, flat, calm day. And I'm looking for kelp rafts and just pulling them up and seeing what I can find. One time I pulled up a kelp raft and it was just like the holdfast, which is essentially the root system of the giant kelp that we have off the California coast here. And it was just full of these little brittle stars, just like covering my paddleboard after I pulled them out. There's lots of cool little things that you probably might ignore, but, you know.
Right.
If you know what to look for.
That's life, just trying to notice more.
Yeah.
You say it was called kelp rafts?
Like a, you know, when the kelp kind of pulls off the bottom
right.
and drifts out to sea. I know, as a spear fisherman.
I didn't know it was called the kelp raft. It's a new one for me.
Yeah. So good place to
look at.
To hunt, too.
Right. Yeah, of course.
Fish will kind of aggregate underneath that shade.
Wow, that's super cool. So how did you get into doing downwinders and stand-up paddleboarding? Have you been doing that for a long time?
Not necessarily. I guess my first ocean activity as a kid, I grew up fishing. My dad loves to fish, so it's just something that I've always done. And then, I don't know, when I was on, I worked on Catalina teaching marine science at one of the outdoor education programs for several years. We had an old, like, broken kite surf board, and someone modified a broken kayak paddle into a paddle board.
Cool.
And, you know, we'd take that out every now and then, and I just loved the vantage point of exploring the coastline that way, seeing what's under the kelp, you know, throw some snorkel gear on there too and go on a little adventure.
Catalina, too, is the waters are so clear out there, and
yeah,
I would, that's like cream of the crop.
The south swell that we love here as surfers, right? When the south swell hits Catalina, it kind of murks things up a little bit, but generally speaking, yeah, it's beautiful.
When was it that you were working out there? And for people who also aren't familiar with this area, Catalina is how many miles off the coast of California?
26.
26. Okay.
So says a song from the 50s. I think it's like the paddle that I'm thinking of doing is maybe 23.
Okay.
So at the closest points, it's a little bit closer than that.
Right. But it's an island that I believe is still owned by the Wrigley family. Right?
I think it's under, like, there's the Catalina Island Conservancy that manages most of the island. Now I'm forgetting the details, but
I know that the Wrigley family, they own or like, and they, I believe, lease out all the land to the Conservancy, but it's largely protected land, if I'm not mistaken. Yep. There's like very few cars on the island. People will go into Avalon, which is kind of the touristy section, the touristy little town. Walk around for the day, kind of feels like you're in the 1950s in some like strange, quaint other world.
Or you're in some like European island town. Right. It has like Monaco vibes a little bit.
Definitely Monaco vibes, like big church bell, you know, out there. And then the rest of the island is like pretty largely undeveloped.
Right. So there's another small town that just has a general store and a campground, essentially. On the other side of the island called Two Harbors. But aside from that, you know, it's hiking, camping, and a few marine science, like, teaching facilities. And USC has a lab and kind of science center as well, where they're doing research.
Okay, so you, what drew you to taking that job out there?
I had come to UCLA for college. I had wanted to go to film school, and that was my goal. And then I took an oceanography class as my science credit my first quarter, and sort of set me on a new trajectory. And I was working and interning at some of the little aquariums we have here in LA, the Roundhouse Aquarium at the end of the Manhattan Beach Pier in sort of the South Bay, in the LA area. And also there's a little aquarium underneath the Santa Monica Pier. So I was an intern kind of on the aquarist side, which is what you would call a zookeeper at an aquarium, essentially.
Right.
And that kind of got me in this ocean science, outdoor ed, kind of hands-on learning, experiential learning world.
Okay. That's interesting. So it wasn't like a childhood dream to become, to get into oceanography and marine science. You were on the film trajectory.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's some point in grade school where I was like, I want to be a marine biologist, right. As everyone
as all of
did.
Us. Yeah, because you grew up fishing, right? Like you grew up in Florida, fishing family,
right?
And so you were around the ocean and that kind of world. It wasn't totally foreign to you,
right? Yeah.
And tell me a little bit more about that. So, like, that move out to California. And then being in film school, and then, like, what was it about that oceanography class that really changed? I'm interested in these moments that, like, change direction? Was there anything for you that you recall?
I think it was more like I didn't realize it was a thing, right? You know, you say you want to be a marine biologist, but you think dolphin trainer or something like that, and you don't really realize what it is as a fourth grader or whatever moment in your life that you thought you wanted to do that. And then I took this class, and I feel like it just sort of opened my eyes to the possibilities and the opportunities that might be out there for a different career path. You know,
who is the teacher?
His last name was Arno. I don't know if he's still at UCLA or not.
Okay. But it was a good teacher, I'm guessing.
Yeah. And I got, I still remember getting a 97 on the final, and I was like, maybe this is my, maybe this is my thing. I'm into this.
Yeah. I forget. There's one famous writer who's like, it might have been like Hemingway or something, or something. He was once asked, why do you write? And he's like, because I'm good at it.
Yeah, right.
Like we do things that we're good at and people tell us we're good at.
Positive reinforcement.
Totally. Right? It's everything, yeah. Right? That's super cool. And what were you doing in that class? Do you remember any?
I mean, it was just an intro oceanography class.
Right.
You know, the basics of how the ocean works, the physics, the chemistry, the geology, and of course, the cool animals that live there.
Right.
Yeah.
And then you went from there to working at an aquarium, right?
Yeah, I took an internship. Heal the Bay runs the little aquarium that's underneath the Santa Monica Pier. So I started out as kind of a public volunteer, just educating the public about the animals that they have there. And then I shifted into a role more behind the scenes, you know, helping clean tanks, feed the fish, build tanks.
Cool.
It was a lot of fun, and I learned a lot of hands-on skills. And I'm still, you know, good friends with my boss and mentor over there.
That's fun.
Yeah.
If someone's, let's say, just visiting Santa Monica, and they ran into you at the aquarium, they're like, well, I didn't know that there were animals here besides, you know, seagulls trying to poop on me. What would that conversation sound like? How would you educate them about the animals that are in this, you know, a densely populated area?
Well, the first question that I always got were, are these real? Like, pointing at the sea stars. So there is a whole world underneath the water that we don't even realize. We have these bright orange fish called Garibaldi that most people can spot from, you know, up on the pier or from shore, if they're around, which is also the California State marine fish. Fun fact.
Oh, I didn't know that. Beautiful fish.
Yeah, they are. And territorial, so don't get up in their space too much.
Right.
But yeah. But California is actually a biodiversity hotspot. So biodiversity means like having a variety of plants and animals. And it's known globally for the biodiversity that we have. And a big part of that is in the ocean and underwater, because we have these special currents. So it creates upwelling, which means water from deep below is coming up to the surface. So just like in a garden, right, like you're using maybe compost as fertilizer, everything kind of sinks to the bottom in the ocean. So all of that fertilizer, all of those nutrients are coming back up, and that's the basis for having this really productive ocean ecosystem and supporting all of the amazing animals that we have along the California coastline.
And that doesn't happen everywhere in the world.
It doesn't happen everywhere.
Wow,
in the world.
I didn't know that. Yeah.
Yeah.
As a surfer, my connection to upwelling was it's fucking cold today.
Yeah.
It's springtime upwelling, right? People always think January, oh, that must be the coldest time in the water, but like really it's April up in Northern California, at least. Like Santa Cruz, April is so cold because you get those windy days and that starts to churn up the colder water down below, and it'll be, you know, 49, 50 degrees. Like, can't feel your hands after 45 minutes in the water.
Right. Or if you get that offshore wind steady for a couple of days, right, it's pushing water out. And so water is going to come up from below.
Right.
To fill that gap.
So am I correct in that upwelling occurs because of strong wind patterns?
Yes, and the prevailing wind patterns that we have here.
Okay.
And then there's a condition called El Nino that shifts all of that. And so we get the opposite, and it gets warmer here. And we, you know, it has negative impacts. Well, I shouldn't say fully negative, but it has many
impacts.
It has impacts on the
marine
life as well.
Talking to a surfer about the negative impact of El Nino. We're like, well, I got the best barrel of my life in El Nino.
Yeah. Fair enough. So, yeah.
But it's a confluence of impacts. Let's say that. So I didn't know that. That the basis of a lot of the marine biodiversity that we have in California is because of the upwelling, because mm-hmm. of the nutrients that it creates for the fish and ecosystems and all of the animals below the surface to be able to survive.
Right. Yeah. Okay. That's exactly it.
Got it. Let's go back to the conversation with the tourists from Ohio. So what is there anything else that might kind of knock their socks off in that initial conversation? They're like, okay, so wow, are these sea stars real? Anything else that you would kind of tell them in those early conversations or questions that they might ask that you kind of recall being like, wow, I had no idea?
I mean, I could spout off crazy, fun ocean facts all day long.
Give me a few.
So sea stars, since we're talking about them, they actually, their stomach comes outside of their body to digest their food. And then they'll digest outside their body, right. And then they'll pull that mush back in, and that's how they eat. So it's really cool if they're being fed and they're up against the glass, you can actually see them, like their stomach come out, start to degrade the fish head or whatever they're being fed that day, and then pull that back in, which is pretty cool.
That's very cool.
That particular aquarium also has an amazing fish called the giant black sea bass, which was hunted to near extinction back in like the 20s. They have, I don't know, it's how big it is. How big is that? Like 2 feet?
Yeah.
So there's one on display, which is amazing. And so that's a great story to tell about how human impact affects our marine ecosystems as well.
Right.
And so those are now protected, and we're starting to see them again along our coast.
I mean, we're starting to see that with a lot of fish. Like, if you talk to spear fishermen who were around in the 80s, maybe a white sea bass, like trophy white sea bass, was like 40 pounds. And now you're starting to see people get 50, 60 pound white sea bass. Like, there are success stories of certain species that are coming back compared to, you know, years, like a few decades ago, when there a lot of these animals, if I'm not mistaken, were really had a lot of pressure put on them and were kind of hunted to near extinction.
Yeah, and that's absolutely true. Fisheries management has definitely brought back, right, like having limits to what you can catch, right, and how many you can catch, and, you know, kind of this ban on catching things that are really threatened definitely helps those species. But I mean, it's a little bit about your perspective and your baseline, right? Like, if you grew up and there was nothing and now you're starting to see more, you might think that that's success. But if you go back even further, right, like areas like Point Doom, if you get in there and just sort of see the contrast to other places where you might visit more often and people are putting more pressure on those ecosystems, there's a definite difference.
Sure,
there. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it's... I you know, people might not know the history of hunting in North America, but there's a pretty parallel story of the story of bison in the early 1900s, where by some estimates, people say that there were 60 million bison roaming North America at one point, and by the year 1900, they were essentially hunted to very near extinction. There was a remnant herd on Yellowstone, and it was largely due to people like Teddy Roosevelt, Jim Potsiewicz. Jim Potsiewicz wrote, I think he's the author, there's a great book called Rifle in Hand, and it's about the history of hunting and the North American conservation model, and bringing back bison and a lot of these other species that were hunted to, yeah, to near extinction. There's a really, there's a famous story of Teddy Roosevelt talking about going hunting while he was in office. I believe he went to Montana, and I could be getting this slightly wrong, but I think it was right around the year 1900. He said, on a 2-week trip, I was never out of sight of a dead buffalo and never in sight of a live one. Like the, okay, the impacts that we had had in, you know, under less than 100 years just wiped out the species. But then now, due to a lot of conservation work, this species has come back. So, yeah. I mean, it is interesting just to, like, we see time in terms of the scope of our lifetime.
Right.
And it's interesting that just, like, in one or two lifetimes, you can see these massive changes to ecosystems. It does take time, but ecosystems can rebound if you give them a chance.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, the ocean is full of similar stories too. Think about whaling, right? Like, we have a history of whaling. That was a huge economic driver, particularly in New England and other coastal areas. And there are many species that we're still working on, you know, protections and trying to bring back. The right whale, for example.
What is the right whale?
So the right whale gets its name because it was the right whale to actually harpoon and kill, because they actually float after they're shot and they're killed.
Oh, wow.
So it was easier to bring back onto shore or onto your whaling vessel. So because of that, the right whale was particularly threatened through the whaling days. And we're still working on helping those populations come back
okay.
to something a little more sustainable and protected. Yeah.
So let's talk now. One of the reasons I was really excited to have you on the show is that I think you can help clean up some of the misinformation and misnomers that are going on right now about marine protected areas. Mm-hmm. Current initiatives, 30 by 30, which is a really kind of hot button topic among conservationists and fishermen. And I just tell us, I'm trying to figure out the best way into this conversation yeah. without us getting too muddled, but why don't we just start at what 30 by 30 is? Let's just start there, and then we can kind of find our way out of the weeds if we get
okay.
too,
yeah,
too fast.
Yeah, it gets
in
pretty
it.
Wonky pretty quickly, yeah. so stop me if I
but just,
say something that's
yeah, pretend
confusing.
People know nothing about this.
So I guess I'll start with the problem, right? Because 30 by 30 is an important solution to the problem, which is, you know, we're dealing with climate change, and there are lots of impacts that we're having on our planet from climate change. And kind of alongside that is we're facing a biodiversity crisis. So I explained a little bit earlier that biodiversity is having this, you know, variety of plants and animals around the world. And essentially it's about our existence, right? Like, we need healthy ecosystems. We need biodiversity. We need somewhat of a stable climate to be able to exist on this planet into the future. So,
and it just makes, I would also just say, sorry to interrupt, I also just think it makes the world a more beautiful place.
Definitely, right? There's intrinsic value in nature.
Yeah. Even if we could survive, it's like, do you want to survive on Soylent, or do you want to have a really beautiful, like, delicious meal too? Like, it just, I think biodiversity, it brings more life into the world.
And there's still so much we don't even know about the ocean.
Right.
Expeditions going out, like, they're discovering new species every day. I think something like half of all cancer research is focused on novel compounds that we're, you know, finding in the ocean.
Right.
There's a lot of sort of selfish reasons, too, as a human race, why it's important to protect biodiversity. But also just our connection to nature, as you're saying, that intrinsic value is really important and often overlooked when we talk about conservation.
Right.
So basically, we're having a lot of impact on our planet, how we've used and developed land and other resources. All of these are impacting biodiversity. So we're probably going to lose a million species within our lifetime. And that's 1,000 times more than the extinction rate. like in any time in our history. So a solution to that, there's a paper that kind of lays out a global deal for nature where we protect half of our planet, that's land and water, by the year 2050 is the target. So an interim goal to get there and to try and figure out, you know, what's the compromise between industry, between fishing, between kind of the space that we need to live and use and build cities or whatever. And, you know, kind of work out those details, right? So 30 by 30 is that interim goal. We want to protect 30% of our planet by the year 2030. And what I think is really important and often gets forgotten, right? We're not trying to fully, you know, take people out of nature. A big part of this, right, is keeping our connection to nature and finding ways to make it more equitable to get to nature and have those experiences. There are a lot of really interesting studies coming out about how our connection to nature is enhanced when it's a healthy and thriving ecosystem, when you are able to see animals and kind of experience what the ocean should be or what the forest or whatever, you know, park you're visiting, you know, if it's, you know, conducive to having life there.
Sure.
Right? Like you have, feel more of a sense of connection and stewardship to our planet and to nature.
Okay. So what's, so protection, mm-hmm. like 30 by 30 protection, you say, you know, that doesn't mean that you couldn't go in the water. Is it, so I feel like here's where we could get into the weeds, but it could be important because the, to take the perspective of, you know, I don't want to create a straw man argument here, and I'll do my best to take the perspective of the other side, which is that we already have a lot of protected areas where people can't fish and take those resources, and now California wants to increase those protected mm-hmm. areas, and it's making it difficult for fishermen to earn livelihoods and recreational fishermen to go out to their favorite spots. So the fear is like, I've been going out to this cliff for the last whatever 20 years and I want to still be able to fish here, and you know, that for on the bigger scale, this is my livelihood, I want to be able to fish. Do you feel like that represents the way that the opposing side would represent themselves?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's pretty spot on. And I get it, but, you know, the problems are real, right? And the environment is changing a lot faster than we even fully understand. There's still so much we don't know about the ocean. One important thing I think to note too is California is unique in that we already have this network of protected areas along our coast. They're essentially national parks, but they're underwater, right? And a key component of that is limiting fishing, because fishing does have a significant impact on the ecosystem. But something also that I think gets forgotten is, as fishermen, right, as fisher people, we're sort of, we have this like one track. It's about perspective, right? You're looking for your white sea bass and you're seeing more white sea bass, so things are good. But as I mentioned, like, I love to explore and find all these other critters in the ocean. We've lost a lot. There's a lot of other changes happening that you might not have even realized. The loss of kelp is pretty obvious, but, you know, we've lost a lot of sea stars, which is related to the kelp loss.
And kelp is really important because it's basically the houses.
It's the habitat.
Yeah, it's the habitat. Yeah, that's where you go to grow and hide from bigger predators and perpetuate your species if you're a fish.
But I've been noticing shifts in, you know, like the little tiny fish that you see along the seafloor, small snails and things like that. There are things that I remember seeing 10 years ago along our coast that I rarely see now. So there's a bigger ecosystem here that we need to think about protecting if we want to be able to continue to fish into the future. And I know that doesn't sound fun. Like, if my favorite fishing spot was closed, you know, like, make me sad as well. An area that you've sort of connected with and have figured out and like understand the tide and temperature and how that affects what you're looking for. I completely understand that. But, you know, there is still 70% more ocean to fish and explore and like learn. And so I kind of try and look at it from that perspective as well.
Okay. And when it comes to, so that's recreational. So with the 30 by 30 program across California, so 30 by 30 is a global initiative.
Yeah. So
right?
We have, a state initiative.
Okay.
So California has committed to 30 by 30 at the state level. So that's California land, as well as out to 3 nautical miles. Those are state waters.
Okay.
We also have committed to 30 by 30 at a federal level. So that goes from that in the ocean, it goes from that 3 nautical miles out to 200 nautical miles. That's sort of the U.S. exclusive economic zone is what we call it. Mm-hmm. Getting wonky here. But those are federal waters. And then we've also committed to 30 by 30 at a global level. So the high seas, which are waters that don't belong to any one country, they're beyond that 200 miles. That's half of our planet. And we've committed to 30 by 30 on that half of our planet as well, which I think is really important.
Okay.
Where it gets tricky is what is the definition of conserve? Like, what is the definition of protect? What are you limiting? Who still gets to do what they want to do in the ocean?
Don't take and away my white sea bass, Anuba. I need to shoot one of these things.
Right. Yeah. So...
Okay. Okay, so what is the definition of protect? Kyle can keep going out because he's so bad at spearfishing. They'll be totally safe with him out there. But a better spear fisherman, maybe that's the way you do it. Like, only bad spear fishermen can go out because we're so ineffective. You must have this bad of skill to do it.
Well, so... Well, that aside,
or it should be, maybe it's like, maybe it's like hunting regulations where it's like you can have archery season. We're like, okay, Kyle, like you can go out with a knife, and if you can knife a white sea bass or catch it with your bare hands, you can do it. But you can't have a full spear gun.
Well, that goes to impact, right?
Okay.
So,
right.
You know, they're not all protected areas. Not all marine protected areas are created equal. So, just like you know. Hunting rules in parks along like across the U.S. whether it's Bureau of Land Management land or a national park or state park or something like that, marine protected areas in the ocean have different levels of protection.
Right.
And some are more limiting, and then some are more effective at protecting biodiversity and protecting the ecosystems and life in the ocean.
Right.
So a national marine sanctuary, for example, Monterey is a famous one. The Florida Keys is also a sanctuary. They don't necessarily limit fishing. The key thing that they limit is drilling for oil, which obviously has significant impacts on the ocean ecosystem, but they don't have the authority necessarily to limit fishing. Our California network of marine protected areas, many of them do. So they cover 16% of state waters. And we've already said that they count towards that 30% goal. So theoretically, we're halfway there. But only 9% of those fully limit fishing.
Got it. So Point Doom would be an example of
right.
that 9%.
Yeah.
Okay. And the parallel to that would be Yellowstone Park is... a huge protected area that you cannot hunt. I'm fairly certain that there's no hunting in all of Yellowstone. It's one of the most beautiful places in the world. Outside of Yellowstone, like just north, there are areas where you can hunt. There are hunting seasons and bag limits and tags that you get to be able to hunt those areas. But it might be a fair parallel to be like, it's not that that it's either no hunting or hunting or being able to shoot as many as you want. There's grades of protection.
Right.
And there will be grades of protection along this, along the California coast and throughout various areas of the 30 by 30 goal.
Correct.
Right. Yeah. So it's not like you can't fish anywhere in that's protected under 30 by 30. It's just designated areas have different statuses. Is that correct?
That's correct. Okay. Yeah. And I mean, the what we call fully or highly protected areas. So these are areas that limit fishing altogether. That would be fully protected, or highly protected might allow for some recreational spearfishing, hook and line, that kind of thing, limited recreational take. Those offer the greatest biodiversity benefits, right? So to really reach the goals of what 30 by 30 on what this global deal for nature are trying to do, that is something that we should think about. But I do understand that there's going to be a little bit of give and take and compromise, but, you know, the problems are real, right. And we need to look at these solutions seriously.
How much is it? So I think that there's also like the story that is painted by people who are opposed to 30 by 30 mm-hmm. and marine protected areas is that it's like, hey, these are recreational fishermen, or these are small fishing companies that are mostly line fishing. I mean, I could be wrong about this, but like the shit I really want to stop is like bottom trawling and right. these technologies that we've created that allow you to just sweep the ocean floor of anything in the net's path. Like, explain a little bit about, I don't know, am I missing it, or like, because I always just felt like, okay, we just need to basically just stop all that shit that you see in, you know, the Greenpeace videos, and then we'll be way more well on our way to being able to perpetuate a biodynamic ecosystem in perpetuity.
Yes, that's a good start. But I think we've also fished down the food chain and fish down ecosystems so far, like our baseline is shifted, as I mentioned. And the way that we manage fisheries, right, like what we can catch, how many we can catch, it's designed for profit, right? Like it's designed to take the most out of the ocean and hope that there will still be enough out there to kind of repopulate for the next season and, you know.
Sure.
For the future. But a lot of that, like, we have science that goes into that. We have modeling. But a lot of that is pretty much a guessing game, right? Like, we're guessing. Can't see and count physically, like, every single fish that's out there in the ocean. That's impossible. Right. Or every single tuna or white sea bass or whatever it might be. So we have some scientific modeling, run some numbers through a computer, and we have our best guess of what we can take. Those often don't account for climate change. And, you know, you'd be a fool to not realize that climate change is impacting our fisheries and everything else that's out there in the ocean. So I also see marine protected areas. There is a benefit to fishing, right? Because you're protecting this area and then you're going to get spillover. But I sort of lost my train of thought. Right. What was I saying?
Well, I was just going on, and we should talk about spillover for people who don't know. So what is spillover?
So if you're protecting an important habitat or ecosystem, you have, you know, fish through along the life cycle, right? Small to big. And they're going to be sort of repopulating and seeding the rest of the ocean.
Right.
So they'll swim outside of that zone, and basically you'll have like a home base for that right. particular species to be able to populate rest of the coastline.
Are most fish that we eat off the California coast transient in that way, that they do leave marine protected areas into spots where you could fish them?
Yes. Some species like rockfish don't move all that much. Some species of rockfish, I guess I should say. So to an extent, yeah, like most things are pretty transient, which a lot of folks argue like, why do we need marine protected areas then? We'll just use our catch limits and bag limits and things like that. But again, there are so many more things in the ocean than just those fish. And it's important to protect beyond, like, the things that we manage.
Okay.
These habitats are really important. And they give us, like, a living laboratory to understand how climate is impacting our ocean. As I mentioned, there's a lot we don't know.
Right.
How is temperature change impacting?
So, sorry, go, keep going.
Oh, I was also going to say, you know, when we have like a limit for fishing, right? So maybe you can catch between 22 and whatever inches, depending on what the fish is. When we have a protected area and you have fish that are small to much more mature and larger, they also spawn at different times. So as temperatures are changing and climate is changing, like a particular condition might be more conducive to a particular size of that fish spawning, if that makes sense.
Sure.
So you're kind of creating this insurance policy, right? So if you have fish along that spectrum of maturity, depending on when they spawn, you have a better chance of that species lasting through climate change and sort of adapting to the changes we're experiencing across our planet.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. So does, can you talk, and I don't, it's okay if you don't know, but talk about the different kinds of fishing across the California coast, like long line fishing. Is there bottom trawling on the California coast? Like, just speaking to those different grades in the technology we use to fish, because could, and the where I'm going with that is, like, could that be a potential solution that you, like, you ban bottom trawling or you ban certain kinds of fishing in certain areas, but it would still allow commercial fishermen to sustain themselves? Is there any conversation happening there, or do you think that's a worthy conversation?
I mean, that is a conversation that's been ongoing,
okay,
right, through fisheries management, what you can do where, what kinds of nets that you can use. But then there's always a push to sort of maximize profit. Like anything,
sure,
fishing is an industry, right? And we have managed our ocean to benefit that industry as much as possible. Fishing is the single biggest driver of biodiversity loss in our ocean. And I'm saying this as someone that understands and loves to fish. Like, I love to be out there. I get it. It's a way to connect with the ocean. If we're out there, we love it and we want to keep doing the things that we're doing. But we can't deny the impact that it's having.
Right.
And sort of the dire, I hate to get depressing, but like, it's a dire situation, and now is the moment to do something about it. Our history, you know, we're talking about bison and whaling, right? Like, whaling is no longer an industry because that was of the impact that,
right,
we've had on those animals. And now there are things sort of beyond the control of fishing, particularly with climate change. And we're talking about developing our ocean in new ways. So the threats are only increasing, and these protected areas are so important to make sure that we are saving ecosystems and saving biodiversity into the future.
It is interesting that fishes are really the last wild animal,
mm-hmm,
we hunt for commercial use.
Yeah.
Can't really think of anything else. Really, everything else, that every other protein we eat is a domesticated animal by this point. But fish are unique.
That sounds right.
In,
yeah,
fish are unique in that they procreate so quickly, and
depending on the species.
Depending on the species, yeah, of course, yeah. But they are a really effective protein, right? Like, what was the TED Talk? Alan something? It was called Four Fish. Did you ever see that?
Oh, yes. There's a book.
There's
as
a book
well,
called,
yeah,
Four, and he kind of talks about how fish are this protein that are really great for sustaining, mm-hmm, humans, because many of them, particularly the smaller fish, procreate so quickly and are really good at sustaining us. Do you see, just as on in terms of like a food level and like feeding humans level, do you see farming fish as the solution in a more so that people can continue to eat fish and not have it be potentially exorbitant costs. Like, let's say we protect 50% of the oceans. Like, you can't fish.
Can't fish on the high seas.
Can't fish.
That'd be a good start.
Okay. Can't fish on the high seas. I'm guessing that one of the things that would happen from that is that fish price would increase, correct? Because there would be more
supply
rare.
Supply and demand.
Supply and demand, right? So would a solution be that we just start farming fish the way we do cattle or chickens?
I mean, you know, I was talking about new and emerging threats. Aquaculture is what we would call that. Aquaculture or mariculture. We're talking about marine aquaculture. That is one of the, like, sort of industries that we're talking about putting in the ocean. So that is an active conversation. Where it becomes unsustainable, right, is if we're talking about some of the bigger game fish, so to speak, we still have to catch the food to feed those fish, right?
Right.
So it's having actually a greater impact on the environment because we're catching, let's say, more anchovies than we were before to then feed the fish that we're getting less protein from
feed
people. So I think that there needs to be some thought and sort of policy around, like, what is the most sustainable and effective, efficient way to do aquaculture so that we're getting the nutrients and the protein that we need. Like, what is the right fish? And there are good examples. I think the field of aquaculture is not really what I work in, but there have been a lot of improvements over the last several decades, and we're getting there. But I think we just need to be more thoughtful about what kind of aquaculture fish that we consume to make sure it's not having that sort of negative impact earlier in the process.
Right. It's like the equivalent of we've just transformed so much land in America to feed cattle.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, it seems like the best solution for everyone would be that you could transform industries in such a way where fishermen could still have jobs, but it would not be having such a destructive impact on our marine ecosystems. And those jobs may evolve into something new so that, and that people could still continue to eat fish as a primary protein at a low cost that was not, again, not having negative number impacts on the number of fish and biodiversity in the ocean, right? Like, that would be the best solution.
That sounds great. Let's make that happen.
Okay.
I don't know how. We'll get there.
Yeah.
Well, and, you know, we've been talking about the ocean from the perspective
we're just going to start freaking growing the fish in labs.
Yeah, I mean, also happening.
Yeah.
Right? We've been talking about the ocean from the perspective of fishing, but there are so many other ways that we use and enjoy the ocean. And at the beginning, we started talking about sort of the intrinsic value of nature. And that's another important part of protecting places, right? So we can continue to have that connection to the ocean, get the, you know, wellness benefits of being in nature. Surfers, you know, tide poolers, if you go to the beach with your family on any given day, you know, these are all people that use and rely on the ocean as well and value it for other things than white sea bass,
For sure. I mean, I grew up in a very biodynamic town in Santa Cruz, and growing up as a surfer, I think that I would have, even though I wasn't fishing a ton, I think that I would have had a different connection to the ocean had there not been animals living in it.
Right.
One thing that I just wanted to ask about, just kind of getting into the nitty gritty of 30 by 30, are there any subsidy programs for fishermen? So let's say you're a fisherman, you sustain yourself off of this area that you can no longer fish. Do you know if there are any programs that, and now you can't sustain yourself and you don't have a job. Are there any do you know any funds dedicated to subsidizing those people or those industries?
So fishing industry, particularly when we're talking about high seas, a lot of the destruction that's happening globally is because governments are actually subsidizing the additional take, right? So the price of seafood in a lot of places is lower because governments are subsidizing what's happening, which has led to a lot of the biodiversity loss, which is why the High Seas Treaty that we just recently achieved is so important to hopefully start to protect areas.
Right.
Not your question, but, you know, it is something that has been discussed. The thing is 30 by 30 isn't saying you can't fish. It's displacing fishing.
Right.
So yes, some, you know, particular like productive grounds might be shifted, or you might have to move away from them, but we're not saying you can't fish anymore.
Hmm.
Fisheries management still exists, right? There are other rules that's kind of govern fishing. We're just saying these areas have other value and they're really important to the future of our planet.
Right.
So, you know, move a little bit away from that.
Right.
And continue to fish elsewhere.
That's interesting. I was on a call recently just like learning more about this, and I was learning more specifically about like these huge bottom trawlers, mm-hmm. and that there actually aren't that many people working on them. Like these technologies have become so advanced, and with a profit model, you're going to have as few amount of people working to get the perfect profit model is I'm going to get as many fish as I can with one guy.
Right.
Or gal, yeah. Right? Like that you're going to, so I think that there is maybe a misnomer about, this is territory I shouldn't get into, but just about how many jobs would be displaced, because it's, my understanding was that a lot of these technologies have become so mechanized, it's not actually that big of an industry in terms of people working.
Right. I mean, like everything, right? We improve our technology, we improve like our sort of fish finding, you know, sonar or whatever.
Right.
And we've gotten more efficient right. at pulling fish from the ocean. But the problem is the ecosystem doesn't also get more efficient. We're actually making that worse by taking more from the ocean.
Yeah.
So that's a balance, right? Yeah. That other innovations and technology don't necessarily have to grapple with.
Yeah. I almost wish we would have gotten, we're at a point already where AI is fishing, because then people would be like, fuck that. Like if AI was the enemy, but at this point, and you didn't have the romantic story of the fisherman.
Right.
I mean, maybe it'll just get there and then people, it'll be like Rage Against the Machine style, you know, then you have all of humanity on the MPA side. We need to stop AI.
Right.
So I think that that's the most persuasive enemy here.
I like it.
Anyway.
Well, I mean, we had sort of de facto MPAs, right? Like
right.
we didn't have boats that could get out to the high seas many years ago, right? So that was de facto sort of protected if you think about it in that way.
Right.
We've just created the technology, created new nets and mechanisms to be able to extract the most from our ocean.
Yeah.
I
was on I was on this call and I was kind of learning about bottom trawling. Do you know, like, can you explain the technology behind that?
Essentially, it's like, I would say maybe the equivalent is like bulldozing a forest to catch deer, right?
Yeah.
So you're destroying habitat and right. basically taking up everything in the path. It's a net that you're dragging across the seafloor, basically.
And they're like a mile wide.
Yeah, they can be.
And you're just,
you're just raking
everything up.
Everything. So you're destroying habitat. You're catching a lot of other species, even though you're targeting just one. So those extra species are called bycatch in fisheries. No matter what kind of fishing you're doing, whether it's hook and line or long line or seine nets, whatever other nets you're using, you have your target species,
so
and then everything else is bycatch, which you might still use and sell, but oftentimes, right, like it just gets discarded. And depending on how long those nets are out there, like sea turtles or mammals that need to breathe air, they get stuck and they actually end up dying.
Yeah. Ooh, that is so sad. It's so sad. Like, it's so, I hate to put it, like, just go to this place, but it's just so deeply sad that we as a species have these big fucking frontal cortex brains that can make, there's an E.L. Wilson quote, which is, the problem with humanity is that we have Paleolithic emotions, medieval institutions, and godlike technology.
Oh, yeah.
It's wild. All right. I think it's great. I mean, your job essentially is forcing people to think long term.
Yeah. I love the ocean, and I'm here to advocate for it. And you know, the science tells us that marine protected areas work. Science tells us a lot of things that work, and there's also more that we need to learn, and we can adapt our policies as those move forward. But I'm doing what I can to make sure that we have a livable planet and that we still have white sea bass to shoot.
Kyle will get one day, the fabled white sea bass. Oh, that's funny. Yeah, that's like, once Kyle can shoot a white sea bass, you'll know their population numbers are great. There's, because they're just everywhere. Like, that's just so
well. You know, we've banned drift gill nets, which helps.
What are drift gill nets?
So gill nets are nets that you kind of put out in the ocean, and the size of the hole is designed for whatever your target fish species is. So essentially, the fish can swim through, but they get stuck because of like their gill plates, and they can't get out. So those are gill nets. But again, it takes up anything that swims through it. And so it was having a bigger impact. And they were mostly used along the California coast for swordfish.
Okay.
So we've now banned those. And that was a subsidy program where we bought back the nets from those fishermen.
Oh, wow.
And then Boreo, who works with Patagonia, actually, right?
Yep.
They have the program where you can drop off the nets with them.
That's such a cool program. Yeah. It's so smart. Yeah, I interviewed those guys a few years ago. They're very clear thinkers.
Yeah. Sorry, I took us on a tangent.
No, that's a great. That's where we go on this podcast. This is fun. I'm super enjoying that you're willing to go into all these different corners of the conversation. So where are we right now? Are we in like a public comment period, or have there been proposed? Let's stick specifically with California.
Yeah.
Have there been areas proposed and designations kind of segmented yet that people can see as to where the proposed areas are that would become full marine protected areas or partially protected areas?
This is where it gets a little wonky, because with the state, so there's two sort of state agencies responsible for the 30 by 30 and then the protected areas. So we have the Fish and Game Commission that kind of manages our marine protected area network, and then we have the Ocean Protection Council, which is charged with figuring out 30 by 30 for the ocean. So right now, our current marine protected area network along the California coast has been around for 10 years plus. So we're doing a decadal review.
That's so decadal new. Decadal management. That's so review. New. So we didn't have marine protected areas in California before 10 years ago.
Yeah. Some of them are sort of legacy reserves or, you know, refuges, I think is what they were called before that. And different chunks of the coast, the protected areas got established at different times.
Okay.
But overall, our marine protected area network is 10 years old. And the fish are bigger. There are more fish. Like, we invested a lot into monitoring and really studying the impacts of these marine protected areas, which I think is really important, because it gives us the information we need to adapt and make it better so it serves all of us better, right? So that's the moment we're in right now, is do we need to make changes to our current marine protected area network? And that could mean little things like a border might need to be shifted a little bit just so it's easier to find, right? It's easier to put a sign not on like a rocky cliffside so that people know where the boundary is. Or it could be something like, you know, changing the name to make it easier for people to know what you can and can't do there. but it's also an opportunity to expand.
This is no fish cliff. I wonder if it's marine protected area. Okay, keep going. Sorry.
Yeah. So what I would like to see is that we use this opportunity to expand and strengthen that network. So the state right now, the Fish and Game Commission is looking with the Department of Fish and Wildlife. They're looking at kind of prioritizing all the different ideas and recommendations that they've heard. And then we'll kind of move on to next steps through there. But to reach 30 by 30, the state has laid out four pathways. One is through that decadal review. If we end up expanding or strengthening that network, that 16% could grow closer to 30 through that process. We're also looking at strengthening protections in our national marine sanctuaries. So they go out a little bit further, but looking at that sort of 3-mile boundary of state waters, can we create some stronger protections within them to get the biodiversity benefits that we need?
Oh, do that. I'm just speaking selfishly, like purely as a spearfish. I'm like, yeah, just go out as far as you want. I don't care. Just let me still spearfish.
Well,
myself.
We're still talking about the state waters here. So
like, go out to 100 miles. I don't care about those guys. I'm going out like 200 yards. That's all I care about. Keep going. I'm horrible.
And a third pathway, this is really wonky, is something called OECMs, which is other effective area-based conservation measures. This is why it's so hard to do policy, because we have so many acronyms. Yeah. But essentially, if it's like a military closure area, so it's an area designed for something else, but it might actually serve as a de facto marine protected area.
Okay.
So this area is closed for military activity. Hopefully you're not just like bombing the seafloor or whatever. You know, is that something that we could maybe consider a protected area based on the activities that are happening there and aren't happening there? So that's another potential pathway. And then the final one is indigenous marine stewardship areas, which is something I feel really excited about, right? It's an opportunity, I think, to connect coastal indigenous tribal communities back to their ancestral waters and kind of give them the opportunity to steward these areas, revive their customary use practices and traditional, you know, kind of cultural practices. And I think that there's a lot to be learned there, right? Like, they were stewarding these waters for millennia before we dealt with this biodiversity crisis. So hopefully there are potential solutions and lessons learned that we can get from the wisdom of these communities.
So I have a friend who grew up on a Native American reservation in Montana called Arlee.
Mm-hmm.
He's a white kid, but the hunting regulations in Arlee were such that indigenous peoples could hunt on that land, but he couldn't. So would that be a similar thing?
Already something that is happening
in
California's marine protected areas. Not all of them, I have to remember now. And then our national marine sanctuaries, like Native Hawaiians, for example, can still hunt sea turtles.
Interesting.
Right. So there are exceptions that we've made for indigenous communities across the U.S.
How is there like a percentage of Native Hawaiian that you need to be to hunt
sea
turtles?
I'm not actually sure.
Huh.
We can call up Cliff Capone.
Yeah, Cliff. Wow, that's fascinating. That's really fascinating. So it would be a similar thing, like if you're part of the Ohlone tribe in Santa Cruz or something like that, you could go hunt in a marine protected area.
Right. Or
interesting.
Yeah. There are like native grasses used for, you know, traditional purposes as well, right? Like, these are things that might still be allowed. So in marine protected areas, we talked about not fishing, but you're not taking anything, right? You're not collecting shells, you're not harvesting seaweed or anything like that, right? Like, you're leaving the ecosystem untouched. You can swim around and explore and experience being around all of these critters. But there are other things that were harvested for traditional use that might still be allowed.
Are
still allowed in certain areas for native tribes.
Okay. And are there, I know we're getting into the weeds here, but it's interesting. Are there any areas in California that are designated for indigenous peoples that where other people can't
so
fish or hunt
there's
that
a
area.
New tribal marine stewards network. I'm trying to remember the numbers now. I think there are 7 tribes that are a part of that. And then we're looking at creating these indigenous marine stewardship areas that would be what you're saying, right? Like a protected space specifically for tribes.
But that's not new. Steward. That's not new in like rivers, for example. Like I believe up in like the Klamath River, which is a really productive salmon habitat, there are indigenous peoples there. Right.
Yeah.
So that's not the, like on river ecosystems. That's already a thing.
Yeah. We have models, and I think that there's a lot more we can do for like effective co-management, right? Making sure that tribes have the say in how these areas are managed. Mm.
Just to throw a little monkey wrench in the, have you ever read Sapiens?
I have not.
Okay, so it basically blasts the idea that indigenous people managed ecosystems sustainably, and that's one of the ideas in it, and that there were a number of animals hunted to extinction by indigenous peoples before white people ever got there. So what if an area is being managed ineffectively by indigenous peoples and the animals are getting hunted by extinction? Do scientists and lawmakers have the right to prohibit that?
Well, that's what co-management is, okay. Right? Like you're working together to protect an ecosystem. But I also think it's a change in mindset. Like it's a different value system, right? Like we're protecting nature so that we can continue to be a part of nature,
right?
Rather than protecting nature in sort of this colonial, I own the land, right, kind of perspective, right? And I think it's a view on what sustainability really means and really just reducing your impact as much as possible.
Right.
And having like the positive impact on our surroundings and what we're doing. So I think that's really like where we can all stand to learn from and really benefit from.
I agree.
It's sort of the long-term thinking, like that 7 generations principle.
Yeah. And I think that I agree with you. And I think that one of the best tools that we have today that we didn't have a few hundred years ago are scientists.
Yeah.
Like, when tribes were hunting animals to extinction, there were no biologists around to know the impact of that. When white people were doing commercial meat markets in Montana and hunting buffalo to extinction, like we didn't have those surveys. We didn't have people out there tracking numbers, looking at the whole in a way that was being tracked in a sober way and using the scientific method to figure out what the best solution is. So I just say that in that I think that the work that you're doing, you know, as a scientist, the people who are out there tracking this kind of stuff really should be listened to.
Yeah. Well, and then there's this idea of traditional ecological knowledge, right? I think our modern view of science is it is a little bit limiting, right? Like you have to have credentials and like be published in a paper and things like that. But like even just being out there regularly surfing or spearfishing, like you're observing and you're seeing changes in our ecosystem. I have no doubt that even, you know, all those years ago, we saw that all the bison were being killed and there were not going to be any more. It's a shift in value and perspective of like we want them to be there and knowing what that impact is.
Totally.
That and, I think is the difference.
Don't ask a barber if you need a haircut.
Right.
Like, or it's like your friend who's like in love with the girl who's not into him at all, but he really wants it to be so. So he's like, yeah, like she called me once last month. I think we're in love still. And you're like, your incentives are clouding your view of reality.
Right.
You need a relationship biologist to say this one's gone. You need to.
Well, and I can like cherry pick science to fit whatever I want, right? I think it's what sort of leads you, right? And I think it comes down to your values.
Yeah. Oh, well.
On that deep note.
this was such a fun podcast. I learned a lot. I appreciate you educating me on what's happening. And if people are looking to get more involved in this, looking to learn more, what are the best resources that you recommend?
I work for the Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC, nrdc.org. We'll have like an action alert if you want to sign in support of our Marine Protected Area Network. I can make sure that link gets to you if you want to share on social media. You can follow me on social media as well. And I'll share updates as they come and opportunities to get engaged in public comment, right? Like this is a public process, so you have a say in what happens in our ocean. Right. So you have a right to have your voice heard, whether you're on my side of the argument or not, and I support that fully.
Oh, democracy. You. Oh, yeah. Okay. And the best ways to have people make their voices heard about what they want is through these public comment periods.
Yeah. So the Marine, getting wonky again, the Marine Resources Committee of our Fish and Game Commission is going to be prioritizing what's happening with the decadal review on July 20th. So that's the next public comment opportunity, and that's going to continue on. So I'm happy to continue posting those opportunities sharing.
I'll just get my ChatGPT on it.
Yeah.
And just pose as 10,000 supporters.
Great. Love it.
I wonder if that's happening yet.
Let's use AI for good.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And can people get in touch with you on social media anywhere?
Or yeah, Anupa like Asokan.
Okay.
It's my full name.
Yeah.
Boring, but.
It's a great name. Yeah, you know, as I said, just to wrap this up, like I said on a first call that we had, I think that it's really courageous of you to be putting yourself out there. In life, as we grow up, we tend to get knocked down once or twice by people who don't like us and then just hide often because that was uncomfortable. It wasn't fun. It's so much easier to just stay in your lane, but that's not how history bends in a moral direction. And I see you as one of those people sticking your neck out there and continuing to speak for what you believe, and I really respect that.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. I love the ocean, right? So I'm doing it for my favorite place.
I'll see you on your next downwinder.
All right. Let's do it.
Thanks.
Thanks, Kyle.
That's our show. Before you head off into your day, you can go to tierman.substack.com to get my newsletter, my articles, thoughts, ramblings. If you want to hear more from me, tierman.substack.com is the place to be. That's it for now. Thank you so much for tuning in. Get out in the water, whatever body of water is closest to you, lake, river, bathtub, or ocean. I promise it will make your day better. See you soon.